I'm knocked over again. But I just thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. I just feel like I shouldn't mention everybody, like Regin and Marion and Brendan and Jim and everybody I saw from North Albany, Jim and Mike Connors. I just should be a conversation. Anyway, I did write something because I get tongue-tied. But I thank everybody, all these people who performed here tonight. This is marvelous. And Kathy for hosting this event and letting it unfold in this elegant rotunda here in this most elegant city hall. When I have to make an historical footnote here, that this building was built in 1881 by the architect H.H. Richardson and was judged in that decade and probably beyond to be one of the 10 most beautiful buildings in America. And Richardson was also working on the Capitol across the street at that time, and that too was in the beautiful top 10. It's so unusual for this to happen here and for a writer to receive honors such as these presented tonight. Mostly these honors are engraved on plaques or written on parchment or etched on glass rectangles and bowls, and they arrive in the mail or in phone calls. But they rarely come with a fantastic chorale and a five-star movie and state legislature, county legislatures, and the mayor and the lieutenant governor. This doesn't happen. But I must add here, the two previous mayors did honor me, and I felt I should mention them. One was Tommy Whalen. I had keys to the city. One from Tommy Whalen, and one from Jerry Jennings. And also, in 2016, Mayor Sheehan herself gave me one, which adds up to three keys. Brendan suggested that it might be time for the city to change its locks. I'm so immeasurably grateful for all this attention, which is based on my books and my role with the Writers Institute, but occasioned by the fact that I just turned 90. In Gabriel García Márquez's last novel, his hero turns 90, and he has breakfast. And then he has breakfast again because he forgot the first one. I'm still doing one breakfast. But now, now and then I do it at 3 p.m, since I sometimes go to bed at 4 a.m. after trying to discover whether the thing I'm working on is really a new novel. Kathy announced, she didn't know she announced this because she really didn't, but I saw the speech that she was going to write. It was written for her, I think. A good reporter gets access. And she said she did not want to be a character in my new novel in that speech. I didn't know that she changed her mind. There's a couple of mayors in Roscoe, and maybe one or two turn up in the other novels, but I was adamant about this, that I didn't know whether Kathy and her administration might turn out to be novel-worthy in the years ahead. Who knows how many years ahead the mayor is going to run for office. In the improbable politics of Albany, anything's possible. So I'm making no promises, but now that you, I don't have to worry about it. I knew, and as a reporter, I covered all the mayors since 1940. I even knew the mayor before that, who had been in since 1926. I don't think I ever had a conversation with him. John Boyd Thatcher. But Jerry Jennings was before Kathy, and he was one of my neighbors in North Albany. And before him, Tom Whalen, who was a drinking buddy of mine. And after Tom retired, he was going to go to Ireland and Cork, I think, University at Cork, to teach a college course in politics. And he asked if I'd go and co-teach with him in a few classes. I said I would. But then Tommy's car went off the road, alas. As to Erastus Corning, I remember when he went to war as the young mayor in the 40s, and he came back as the mayor. And I was often in his office as a reporter in the 50s and 60s, and then about 1965, I became his public enemy. I was writing for the Times Union about our civil rights battle. You know, Earl Thorpe is back there. The brothers, and I wrote a lot about the brothers. And there's some of those stories that I wrote were very tough on the mayor and on the Democratic organization. And one day I came to a common council chamber upstairs, and I was covering a major community meeting about the federal anti-poverty program that Albany didn't want to set up. We became the last sizable city in the country to accept such a program. Everybody else got it, but we didn't want it. Dan O'Connell never wanted it, and neither did Erastus. And they wouldn't let me into the meeting to cover it. John Klein, the county attorney, was on the door, and he turned me away. John didn't approve of me. My editor was Dan Button, and capriciously, John let him in, so Dan covered the event, and I didn't. But then in the late 70s, after I'd left the newspaper, and when I was about to publish my third novel, I had a most improbable phone call from Erastus asking me to write his biography. He said I could write anything I wanted about him, and that he'd write a rebuttal to it at the end of the book. Neither of us had ever heard about such a book as that, but we did go forward with it, and we had great talks. Very candid, revealing stories, his language very comic and salty. I just sat and took notes the first time, and the second time I wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything, so I brought a tape recorder, and he clammed up, and the stories were boring, and not boring, but you know what I mean. So I never had used the tape recorder again. But we went to lunch a few times, and I learned a lot, and we became good friends. The book never happened, but I sent him a long profile I wrote on him for O Albany in early 1983 when he was dying very slowly in a Boston hospital. And when he died in June of that year, Ed Daig asked me to do commentary with him on TV at the mayor's funeral, and I did. And the next day on Deadline, I wrote his obituary for O Albany as that book was going to press. That was 1983, and I started the Writers' Institute that year. I've often told stories of how and why I started it, but maybe I haven't said enough about my major motivation, which was to give young, struggling, unpublished writers such as I had been a chance to talk face to face with an established writer and ask about writing, such as the plaintive question that I'd burned in my brain for so long when no one would accept my work. What is it that I don't understand? When nobody was publishing my stories and early novels, I asked that and a lot of other questions to one major American writer, and he told me things I didn't really want to hear about my work. He didn't tell me how to write. He told me how not to write, how to recognize bad prose, especially when I wrote it. He didn't tell me how to write prose that was as brilliant as his own, which is something nobody can ever do. But his insights helped move me out of literary innocence and toward a new definition of myself as a creator of stories that editors would soon buy and people would read. All of that happened in Puerto Rico. And when I came up here to work in 1963, I still had a few miles to go to escape my apprenticeship, and the Times Union, the publisher there, Gene Robb, a great fellow and a sterling newspaper man, wondered why I wasn't getting my writing accepted, and he suggested I go out to the new university and take a writing course. But there were none, and I didn't want one, really. I was freelancing by then, and to make an extra buck and interviewing writers, James Baldwin, Bernard Malamud, John Cheever, Arthur Miller, anybody who was in range, I'd interview them and write a piece for magazines. And more, I was picking their brains about writing as I talked with them. I'd also discovered a book called Faulkner at the University. William Faulkner at the University of Virginia, talking to student classes and faculty gatherings about his books, his prose style, his inspiration, how he began as a writer, and on and on and on. During 57, I think, taped audio sessions in the spring of 1957, when he was writer in residence at Virginia, I devoured this book 5 or 6 times. What a great development his presence was for those students in that university. And this was in the back of my head for years. I was a Faulkner freak, and I read most of his work, studied a lot of it, and was fixated on The Sound and the Fury, one of his masterpieces, as a model, inimitable, but as a model. It was a difficult book, and it encompassed the world. A family in the town of Jefferson in the county of Yoknapatawpha, which was a fictional version of the area around Faulkner's hometown of Oxford, Mississippi. Almost all of his work was set in this place, and he even drew a map of it. Faulkner referred to it as a cosmos and related it to the vast interlocking of cities and people in the books by Balzac. And in that book of conversations with Faulkner, which you can now listen to online or download, Faulkner talked about his first mentor, Sherwood Anderson, who wrote the classic collection of stories, Winesburg, Ohio. What Faulkner said he learned from Anderson was this: that to be a writer, one has first got to be what he is, what he was born. And he quoted what Anderson told him, quote, "You have to have somewhere to start from, and then you begin to learn. It don't matter where it was, just so you remember and ain't ashamed of it. Because one place to start is just as important as any other." Such interlocking worlds in literature were magical to me. The works of J.D. Salinger and Joyce and Hemingway. But Faulkner's creation was the most stunning. I never thought I'd try to do such a thing. For one novel alone, writing one novel was an immensity. But then, after my third novel overlapped somewhat with my second, and then that one begat the fourth, which begat the fifth and sixth, and all of them stood alone as novels, but they were all interrelated with recurring characters. And this was an open-ended series of books. The early three were never really a trilogy, though they were marketed as that. And so I called it the Albany Cycle, for all of them were about Albany, which, as we all know, though I didn't always think so, has a fabulous mercurial history, isn't it? It's a great town. Also a town that's seen enormous trouble. And I decided I loved the place and would never leave it and never write about any place else. In my last novel, Shango's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, the first half is set in Cuba, and people ask me, how could you do such a thing? I explained that it was a book about a fellow from Albany who was down to Havana, but then he comes back. The book I may or may not write next is also set in Albany, much of it in North Albany, Mike, where Jerry Jennings and I were raised and Mike was raised. There's a lot more to it, but I'm not saying anymore. And since I'm not saying anymore, this is probably a good reason to stop talking. So I thank you for all this wonderful hoopla and this grand, elegant embrace. It's great stuff. Thank you, thank you, thank you.